Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Today, host Teresa Wilkie talks with Jamie McLaren, a young woman who was arrested for an outstanding warrant she didn't even know she had, and Grandview Municipal Court Judge Ronald Johnson about the warrant amnesty days in his jurisdiction. Then, host Craig Lubo talks with Charisse Fanot-Burdine, Chief Executive Officer of the Pretrial Justice Institute, about their research and programs that are meant to reduce pretrial incarceration and help the working poor avoid an economic disaster because of minor charges. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 Drug War News at the end of the broadcast. Up next is Teresa and her guest.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Monday morning, another Jaws of Justice. I'm so glad you're listening. We're going to talk the first part of the hour about warrant amnesty, which is an idea that came to my attention because of an action group in New Orleans, the Workers' Center for Racial Justice, which is a Stand With Dignity project where people in New Orleans have been invited to come in on one particular day to have their warrants and interest removed where they can just pay the original fine and it frees citizens to operate their vehicles and find jobs, and it's just a very good idea. So I wanted to look locally at what kind of action like this is being done in our community in the Kansas City area. The first part of our program will be a recorded interview I had with Jamie McLaren. She's a young woman who lives in Leavenworth, Kansas. Let's hear from Jamie now. We're talking with Jamie McLaren. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
And Jamie is a young woman who lives in Leavenworth, Kansas, and she got pulled over December 28 for allegedly speeding by the Leavenworth County Sheriff's Department. Is that correct, Jamie?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, so what happened when they pulled you over for suspicion of speeding?
I was on my way to work, and so when I got pulled over, of course he came out and asked, why I pulled you over. I was like, no, I'm just on the way to work. And he basically did his thing, like, oh, you were speeding and stuff, and he asked me for my license registration. I gave it to him. So when he went back to his vehicle, I would say a couple minutes, maybe like 2-3 minutes went by. He came back to my vehicle and told me that, do you know your license was suspended? And I was in shock. I was like, no, I had no clue. What day? When was it suspended? What was the reason? He went back to his vehicle again and came back. He was like, well, it looks like you had a valid insurance. And so I'm like, okay, I just gave you my insurance, but you can see it's not invalid. So I was very confused. He was like, okay, well, let me try to figure some things out. Let me go back to my car. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is, thinking in my head, this is really weird because I've never had valid insurance. So he went back to the vehicle. He basically told me to get out the car, and I was being arrested for driving while suspended.
For driving on a suspended driver's license.
Yeah, suspended driver's license.
And did you have any notification before this event that your driver's license wasn't valid?
I had no notification, none at all.
So you were stopped by the police, and you gave the officer your driver's license and the vehicle registration and proof of insurance. He takes it back to his vehicle, comes back and tells you your driver's license is suspended. And this is a surprise to you.
Correct. I asked him, what day was it suspended? The date he gave me was literally 2 days before he stopped me.
And what happened after that?
He arrested me, put handcuffs on me, and called a tow company to come get my car.
He said, you're under arrest.
Yes, he told me I was under arrest for driving while my license was suspended.
Okay, and so you were handcuffed. Okay.
Correct.
And then what happened?
And then he tells me that he's going to call a tow company to come get my car. I was kind of shocked. I was like, well, I have somebody that can come get my car. And he was like, oh, no, we're just going to call a tow company. So that's what he did. He called a tow company, and they came out and towed my car. While they were done doing that, he took me. I had to ask him, can he get my keys, my purse? Like, everything was still in my car. He didn't get anything for me. He was like, oh, yeah, okay. So he went and got that. While the tow company was about to leave, I was like, oh, hold on. I need the tow company's name. I said, I need their information. He was like, oh, you can look on the car. Their car had their name listed. And he was like, oh, you can look on their car. You can look them up. And he took me to jail.
So what jail did he take you to?
It was in Leavenworth County, so I came back to Leavenworth.
This was police headquarters or the municipal jail?
The municipal jail.
Okay, so then what happened?
So I got logged in and everything. The people who worked there, they did my fingerprints and everything, asked if I ever been there before. And I'm like, no, this is my first time. He said, why are you in here for? And I was like, well, he told me I was driving while suspended. And he looked at me like, huh, okay. I guess there were no female guards to, like, make sure I didn't have anything on me. So I was in the holding cell for at least 5 hours, I believe. And I was able to call my mother to call her a co-sign for me for the bondsman. And I had to pay them $100 to come get me out. They came a little after the 5 hours to come get me.
And listeners, I want everyone to understand, Jamie is a young woman with children and a job. She hasn't had episodes with the police in the past. So I'm sure this was a really big surprise to you to wind up in jail, and certainly a very big surprise to your mother to get a call from you that she needed to come help you get out of jail. Let's tell our listeners again, in case they're late tuning in, there was a suspended driver's license. And how did that happen? And you weren't even aware of it. How did your driver's license get suspended?
In contact with an attorney, went through an investigation on how this happened initially. What happened was, when I was coming back from work, that time I was speeding, and I got pulled over. That was back in October.
Of last year. So October 17, you were actually driving too fast, and you got pulled over by the police. Now, what community, where were you then?
That was in Shawnee County.
Okay.
He pulled me over. He did not issue me a ticket. Because he basically gave me a warning. He said, I like that you were honest with me about what you did, and I let you go. But I did not have my insurance card on me. Valid, I didn't have the card. He told me to go to the court in Shawnee and show them that I had proof of insurance, the actual card. I said, oh, that's no problem. That's no problem. So that Monday, because this was a Sunday, I got off work. I went straight there and showed them the card. The lady, the clerk desk, told me everything was okay, that you didn't have to worry about a thing. And that's basically what happened. I'm not going to blame anyone, but it was a mess up where I'm assuming that nothing got in imported like it should have. It came in the system that I had no insurance.
Did you have to pay a fine at the Shawnee County Courthouse when you went in?
Yes. This last time I had to go back and show them again, and I had to pay, I believe it was $184.
Well, when did you pay that? After you were held in jail or before?
After.
After you were held in jail. So it sounds to me, listeners, that what happened to Jamie is she was driving too fast, stopped, couldn't show insurance, had a fine, went to the courthouse to pay the fine, and somehow that didn't get paid. And from that event, your driver's license was suspended. And then you were unaware your driver's license was suspended when you were stopped again months later, because you had a suspended license and apparently a warrant, you were taken to jail. Is that what you have later found out?
Correct.
Well, I'm glad you have that all cleared up. Did you have to have a court date, or how much did this cost you other than the $150 fine?
Mind you, they dismissed everything, but I still had to pay court fees. So my attorney plus court fees was at least $400 altogether, not including the $184 I paid.
Just under $1,000. And how much time did it cost you? You didn't have to spend overnight in jail, is that correct?
Yes, most of the day, but no, not overnight.
Sometimes when this happens to people, it impacts their job. They're not lucky enough to have someone they can call to help them post bond and get out so that they can continue with their responsibilities. So you're very, very lucky that you have a strong network of support, but that's exactly the issue. It doesn't go that way for relatively innocent people who are guilty.
It just happened at a really bad time, because when my card came in the mail, it was like that week my new one came in the mail. So I didn't get to the mail in time to get that new card in my billfold.
Oh, you're talking about the card of your insurance. Help everybody to know to keep those cards on them at all times. They're behind the wheel of a vehicle, sure.
Absolutely, because it can turn a really ugly situation really fast.
Well, Jamie, I'm glad that everything worked out for you, and we're going to transition now. I've got an interview with a judge in Grandview, Missouri, who that community court is trying to help people who have outstanding warrants and fines. You paid all your fines, but other people have these offenses and then interest accrues, and it makes a bad situation even worse. So thank you for talking with us today. I really appreciate you.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
This is Teresa Wilkie. We're going to call in Judge Ronald Johnson from the Grandview Municipal Court. Judge Johnson, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Terry. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing this morning?
Better and better, as usual.
So, Judge Johnson has also with him Rebecca Diedrich. She's court supervisor in the municipal courts in Grandview, Missouri. Now, that's a Jackson County community, Grandview, Missouri. How are you this morning, Ms. Diedrich?
I'm fine, thank you.
So,
and her proper title is court administrator.
Yes, thank you. And the reason we have her called in is because she's the one who knows all the rules. Thank you for being with us. Okay, now, the city of Grandview has had more than one warrant amnesty court day. Is that correct?
That is correct. I think we have a list of them. Becky, when did we have them?
The first one that I have participated in when I came into Grandview was in 2012. And we've had one every year except for 2014 since I've been here.
So you do them every year. And how do you get the notice out that this is a chance for people who have outstanding fines to go in and pay the original fine and waive all the accrued costs, correct?
Well, the fines and the court costs is what they would have to pay. By law, there is no other fees that can be assessed except for what is, by statute, is allowed that we can collect. So there are no other, fees associated. So no interest or anything like that. But this does give individuals a chance to come in without the fear of being arrested and see the judge, get a new court date, pay fines if they can, get a new court date scheduled, and things like that.
And Terry, there are no more failure to appear fees that historically the courts in Missouri have charged, which was quite a burden to many defendants, but those have been eliminated by law.
That's a very good thing. I also, to prepare for this interview, I interviewed a municipal court judge in Kansas City, Kansas, and perhaps that's why I think that interest accrues on fines. Maybe Kansas hasn't changed their statute at this time.
Right. State by state, there are different laws that govern what can be collected. In the state of Missouri, we can't collect any kind of failure to appear fees. That was abolished by state law back in 2015.
So those who want to learn if they have an outstanding warrant or fine should call the Grandview Municipal Court at 816-316-4837. Or is there a list on the website? What's the website?
We don't have an active list. We only put that up when we are doing an Amnesty Day program, but they can call anytime to our number, or they can go on to the website if they decide they want to pay their fine, and they can just look up their name at grandview.org and go to the municipal court tab. So they can put in their name and their date of birth and check and see if they have any active fines and fees that can be paid as far as their, you know, fines and court costs. If it can't be paid, then they would need to contact us here at the court.
This is pertaining to nonviolent offenses such as speeding, driving on suspended license.
Right. Anything that's already been sentenced, they can pay. If it's in, something that's not sentenced, then they would need to contact the court and see about just coming in and seeing the judge. And then he would talk to them, you know, and see what they're going to plead. But what you were talking about as far as a minor traffic offense, speeding, plate violations, parking, no insurance and things to that nature, then they can pay online or at the Traffic Violations Bureau here at City Hall.
Yeah, Terry, it gives them an opportunity to see me as the judge to pay their fines or plead not guilty or guilty. If they plead not guilty, we set them a new court date. And the good thing is they don't have to worry about being arrested or confined at any time because they are taking the initiative to come in and see me. And I might add that to many defendants, they don't realize that by simply communicating with the court, they can avoid a lot of things. We're not here to be hostile toward them. We're here to assist. And if they have problems such as not having the money to pay the fines and they need a payment plan, we can set that up for them so that they don't have to run, be in fear of being stopped by an officer for some traffic violation and being put in jail.
Thank you for saying that. I do honestly believe, and I don't think this is an urban myth, that people who have trouble with motor vehicle offenses will go on the lam, so to speak, and then they don't have a valid driver's license, which affects their ability to find employment. Because driver's license is one of the first things that's asked for to show proof of citizenship. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yes.
Right. And one of the things that we really encourage is to come in and get it taken care of. And, you know, we'll help them in any way we can to try to get those suspensions or a hold on their driver's license taken care of so that they can get it, you know, employment and things like that. And we really recognize that there's a lot of financial hardship that citizens may be experiencing right now. And, you know, times are difficult for everyone. So we really want to help them, you know, to get those things cleared up.
And I simply Googled the Missouri driver's license website. So that is DMV. It's www.dmv.org/Missouri-MO-Missouri. And a person can go online and check the status of their driver's license and also make sure their address is correct, because don't you see this is one of the problems? People move a lot these days.
Right.
And notices are sent to the address on their driver's license, which is not their address. So they don't get these notices.
Right. And we're very active in sending a warning notice to individuals before we take any kind of action as far as a warrant is concerned. So we do send a 30-day warning notice, and then we'll send a show cause notice. So they actually get a couple notices before any action is taken. So, you know, we do try our best to contact them, and you're absolutely right. You know, people do move a lot, and so it's great if they could look and see, you know, what the last address is on their license and update that information. So that would be very beneficial.
The website for Kansas is www.kdor.ks.gov. So a person can check the status of their Kansas driver's license. Now, let me ask you, Judge, if a person has an outstanding fine and they don't work out a payment plan and they get stopped in Kansas City, Missouri, or Lee Summit, or Kansas City, Kansas, might they be arrested or detained?
Yes. If they have an outstanding warrant for failure to make the proper arrangements, then yes, the officers in those local jurisdictions have, they will check and see if there's any outstanding warrant. If they find a warrant, they will arrest them, and they will eventually be transferred to Grandview Court. I mean, Grandview Jail, I should say.
Thank you for that. We just have a very few more minutes, but when I was checking to set this program up, I tried to find other warrant amnesty courts in the Kansas City area. And Grandview is one that has a history of doing it and continues to do it. Kansas City, Kansas did it once in 2011 or 2013. I don't see any evidence that Kansas City, Missouri has ever had a warrant amnesty court. There may be one in Olathe. Are you familiar with other communities that have done this?
I came from Joplin, and we started a program there in Joplin. I know they are. I heard that some other smaller communities around the Kansas City area are also having the amnesty program. So I know that, you know, there are communities out there that are, you know, doing the same type program. I don't know how, you know, they're getting the information out or not, you know, but we have several warrants here at Grandview, and like I said, we're always trying to get the word out to individuals to come and see the judge. Even when they come to the window, you know, we encourage people, or they call in and they're saying, I have a warrant, we encourage them, you know, to come to court Monday and talk to judge, and he'll set them up on a payment program or talk to them and give them their options.
I want to thank you for that. It gives me great heart to hear a community. Now, this really is counter to another urban myth that people, we believe that cities, governments are just trying to get rich off of us. And so what you're saying is, in your community, you would like to work with people so that they have an opportunity to live their life free of having to pay extra bills. And I congratulate you for that. It's terrific.
We appreciate that. Yeah, we know that everyday challenges get in the way for everyone, and we don't want to make it any more difficult. And we will do anything reasonable to work with someone to try to keep them in good standing.
Now then, listeners, you know me, so when you elect your city and county commissioners consider that warrant amnesty days can occur in every municipal court in the area and ask for that and try to support people running for office who are interested in setting up these kind of terrific programs. I thank you both very, very much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you so much.
Now the calendar for the week of April 30th. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, May 1st from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. The Missouri Poor People's Campaign and Stand Up KC will be holding civil disobedience training Thursday, May 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, 3800 Troost Avenue, KCMO. You can join them as they learn nonviolent civil disobedience to advance the campaign's demands to end the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. They will train and learn how to effectively wield nonviolence as a weapon for making the moral, economic, and political changes America so desperately needs. The documentary film, The Occupation of the American Mind, Israel's Public Relations War in the United States, will be shown Thursday, May 3rd at 6:15 p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. The film is co-sponsored by Citizens for Justice in the Middle East and All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church and will be followed by a panel discussion. The Kansas City Chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, May 4th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. This month's forum is TIF for Tat, Who Benefits? Guest speakers are Councilwoman Alyssa Kennedy, Jan Parks of the Coalition for Kansas City Economic Development Reform, and Bruce Eddy, Executive Director of the Community Mental Health Fund. They will discuss the good and bad effects of tax increment financing. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting May 4th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, KCMO. POMC meets to provide support and assistance through ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness to all survivors of homicide victims. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Coming up next is Craig Lubo and his guest.
Hey, this is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us. Today I have Charisse Burdeen on. She is with the Pretrial Institute. And Charisse, did I say your name correctly?
You absolutely did.
Okay. Charisse has spent over 20 years working to improve public safety policies and practices across the country. Since 2006, she has developed innovative strategies to raise awareness of pretrial justice issues, amassed a broad constituency of criminal justice stakeholder groups, and provided technical assistance and training on policy reforms to stakeholders within the criminal justice system. Welcome, Charisse.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about one of the big things in pretrial justice is the bail, and some people know it as bond system. So let me have you, if you can, define what the problem, the overall arching problem is with the bail system.
Sure, thank you. So we usually describe the bail system as being broken in two fundamental ways. The first way is that typically, people who present little to no risk of flight or risk to public safety are being detained in the country simply due to an inability to be able to pay a bond to be released. So you end up having a lot of low-risk folk detained for days on end, sometimes weeks or months, until essentially they take a plea. And then upon plea, they're typically released either for credit for time served or released on probation. The irony, of course, there is that if they're safe enough to be released on the day they take a plea, why did we keep them in jail for so long prior to that? The second breakage comes on the other end, which is that the money bail system in America today, about half the time, people who you and I might consider too dangerous to be released or too likely to flee, and I mean flee, not forget to come to court, but really flee justice, about half the time those folks are able to use the money bond system to get out of jail. And that obviously has an impact on public safety, victim safety, and court processing. So what we describe kind of as the problem across the country is that the vast majority of people in jail today, in fact, about two-thirds of everyone's jail population in their jurisdiction, are people who are in a presumed innocent status who are simply too poor to post bond.
Let's just look at some of the numbers. On your website, it indicates 6 out of 10 people who are in jail are awaiting trial.
Correct.
Those are people who have not gone to trial and who have not pled or anything. What are the reasons that they keep them in jail, other than in terms of if they can't afford it, but why are they kept in jail if they're not a danger?
So it's true where your listeners are, it's true in most places across the country, that what happens when you get arrested and booked into a jail is that somewhere, at some point, whether it's right there at the booking moment or at some point in the next few hours, someone will tell you the dollar amount associated with the charge for which you have been arrested. So let's say you've been arrested for, attempted robbery. Maybe that's a bad example. But let's say you've been arrested for attempted robbery. And, you know, a charge sound, you know, we all kind of have a frame of reference for the name of a charge, and usually we get that from television. But, you know, attempted robbery. So let's say they tell you it's $50,000 bond for that amount. What will happen then is you either can try to come up with the full $50,000 to get out, or more likely, they will let you know that if you pay 10%, if you can get a bail bondsman to come down to the jail and pay 10% of that, which in this case would be $5,000, if you can pay $5,000 to the bondsman, you can get out of jail. $5,000 is a lot of money for most people. And so let's take a different charge, something minor, some personal possession, for example, of marijuana, for example. In many places, that still simple possession will get you booked into a jail. And let's say the bond is set at $5,000. Again, on a 10% fee to the bondsman, you'd have to come up with $500. Surveys have shown that most people would have trouble coming up in an emergency with $400. And I know for many middle-class or upper-class Americans, it seems unusual to think that someone couldn't come up with a few hundred dollars to post bond. But it is true in most places across the country. The vast majority of people are arrested, of course, for nonviolent low-level misdemeanors. In fact, 75% of all arrests in the country every year are for misdemeanors. And so when you think about who's actually in our jails in America, very, very few people are arrested for very serious violent felonies. So folks end up being detained pending trial simply due to an inability to pay.
What are some of the other options? What can you do instead of bail? If they want to assure defendants going to return for their court hearings, and my understanding is one of the purposes of bail is to, I guess, have somebody kind of on the bond supervising to make sure that that person appears. What are options for that?
Sure. So I was actually listening to the segment right before this, and one of the things I enjoyed about that segment was constant reference to sort of myth-busting. And I think one of the things you've just raised is this myth that folks who pay money bond to get out of jail have to put up something with the bondsman are actually more likely to come to court than people who do not post a bond. But research does not bear that out. In fact, most research shows that people who put up money in order to get out of jail are no more likely to come back to court than people who don't have to post bond to get out. another way of saying that is people for whom they are released on non-financial conditions are as likely to come back to court. So money doesn't really do much in terms of appearance. It's a very kind of old-fashioned court practice that we started, you know, eons ago when you could be arrested on the East Coast and the fear was that you would flee to the wild, wild West. So if anyone kind of, you know, realizes today's technology, it's very easy to keep track of people. And it certainly is the case that because we arrest and jail mostly poor people and working class people in this country, people are not fleeing justice. So what are the alternatives that you asked? There are many places across the country that are implementing or have implemented in the past lots of great alternatives to this. What should happen? I'm often asked that question. What should happen when someone gets arrested? In places across the country, you can be arrested, booked into a jail. Within a few hours, an assessment of your likelihood to come back to court or stay arrest-free pending trial is calculated. And I saw on your website, thank you for posting sort of the full litany of recommendations around how to improve pretrial justice. And one of the first things is around doing an actual objective assessment, not a gut check, not a review of a criminal history that one judge might interpret one way and the afternoon might judge might interpret a different way, but an objective assessment of the probability of this person coming back to court arrest-free. Then the fashioning of conditions. So if someone is 95% likely to come to court arrest-free, we would let them out with a, they should be released pending trial, with a court reminder. Court reminders improve appearance. It's why your doctor's office calls you. It's why your dentist office calls you and reminds you of your appointment. And then there are other conditions. Should it be noted that with a little support in the community, we can help people be successful. It's the other thing I appreciated about your earlier segment, that the court is looking for ways to be supportive of people in making their fines and fees payments. Same is true here. There are lots of things that can be done to support people in getting back to court. Sometimes folks just need help with a plan for remembering to ask off for work, making sure they have childcare if that's necessary, and then certainly the big one, which is transportation to the court.
And oftentimes I see bonds being set on serious felonies, you know, $100,000, $200,000 or higher. And I think judges are looking at the seriousness of the offense, that the defendant may be dangerous. But if, in fact, the defendant is too dangerous to let out, why would there even be a bond set?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, another irony of this system is that we see courts setting, even recently, million-dollar bonds in cases across the country where either the seriousness of the offense, it's typically based on the seriousness of the offense. And as I mentioned earlier, what we know from research across the country is that about half the time, those folks are actually able to post bond and be released. And someone might say, well, wow, how can that be? If somebody can't afford a $500 bond, Charisse, how can they afford a $50,000 bond? And what I say is, think about the premium on a million-dollar bond. That's a $100,000 loan that someone could get into with a bondsman company. And so those are very attractive deals. I always say, as a car salesman, I'd rather sell one Lamborghini and have to bust my tush to sell, you know, 50,000 Honda Civics in a year. So it's the same thing here. Those expensive bonds are very attractive to bondsmen. So what could the courts do differently? Well, typically, you might imagine, and an honest judge every once in a while will admit, that bonds set at those amounts are meant to detain. Because you certainly cannot imagine in any reasonable setting that a judge would believe that a million-dollar bond would assure public safety, when in fact, bonds cannot even be forfeit for rearrest. They are simply about failure to appear. So if I'm a dangerous person and I commit a new crime out on bond, the bondsman doesn't have to pay. I don't have to pay the bondsman. because that bond was written on my appearance in court. So what could judges be doing differently? State courts often do not have the mechanism they need in order to detain someone, and that is a preventive detention statute. So in the District of Columbia, and certainly now in New Jersey with their bail reform practices, what happens is that if the district attorney or the state's attorney believes that someone is too dangerous to be released or too likely of a flight risk, they can request of the court a preventive detention hearing. That hearing has to happen within several days. At that hearing, the state's attorney, the district attorney, is required to demonstrate to the court that there are no condition or combination of conditions that would adequately assure public safety. And often that burden is pretty high, especially with technology today, like GPS tracking or home detention. And so courts really need to have this mechanism of lawfully detaining people pending trial rather than this Russian roulette of setting a dollar amount and hoping the person won't be able to figure out how to make it.
That's one of the differences that I noticed between federal and state. I used to do federal criminal practice, mm-hmm. and now I just do exclusively state. But in federal court, they would detain the person and have a hearing within 2 to 3 days where both sides could present evidence relating to the amount of the bond and whether or not there should be detention or no detention. Whereas in state court in Kansas, that doesn't happen. In Kansas, we can file a motion reduced bond, but it might be 2 or 3, 4 weeks before it's heard. So one of the things that we do have in Kansas, well, in some counties, I don't know if all counties have, in Wyandotte County, we have what's called pretrial release, mm-hmm. which is where they can get them out and they don't have to pay for a bond. And this department gets them out and supervises them. It's very much like being on probation.
Sure.
Is that something that's being done in a lot of other jurisdictions, or are we unique in that, or what?
No, I mean, in this country, since the late 60s, we've had across the country pretrial services agencies or pretrial supervision departments, sometimes within probation departments. And those are folks who will create a support plan for the individual based on the conditions previously set by the court, both help them make sure they remember to get to court on their court date, but also connect them with supportive services in the community if those are, in fact, indicated by, you know, some kind of intake interview. If a risk score or an assessment score says that I'm a 3 on a scale of 1 to 5, and you're a 3 also, Craig, we may be 3s for different reasons. I may have behavioral health issues that I would benefit from being connected to community-based providers. You may not have those, but you may be chronically unemployed, and so you have kind of a longer criminal history of, you know, petty offenses. And so you may need to be referred to community services that help with employment. So pretrial services or pretrial supervision, we like to think of as both support and a little bit of supervision just to kind of help the person get connected to services that will help them regardless of the outcome of their case.
And one of the limitations that Wyandotte County has is they will do it for people with misdemeanors, and they'll do it for people with felonies as long as they are either presumptive probation if they were convicted or border box. But if they're presumptive prison, they generally won't do that. In your experience, is there a reason to be concerned? Do people who are presumptive prison, are they less likely to return?
Actually, again, a great question. It's a bit of a myth. People have this sense that the more serious the charge, the more likely some would be to flee. But if you look at the federal system, we published a report a couple weeks ago called False Equivalence, kind of comparing federal defendants and state defendants. Because if you can imagine, state defendants, federal defendants in particular over the last 20 years, a lot of state high-level felony charges, especially around guns or drugs, have become federal offenses. And so one might think that if you're looking at 40 years in prison, for example, a serious federal charge, you'd be more likely to flee than someone charged with a petty offense. But research does not bear that out. In fact, appearance rates in the federal courts is very high. So what we know from research as well is that the charge alone is not predictive of your behavior on pretrial release. In fact, there are about 6 or 7 items that should be taken into consideration, not just the charge. And it's when you look more holistically and you don't underweight certain things or overweight other things that you get a really clear picture. The truth is most people will make all their court appearances and stay arrest-free pending trial.
And when we're talking about these pretrial supervision programs, of course, there's a cost to that. Can you compare what you see as the typical cost of one those programs with the cost of keeping people in the jail?
Sure. So we just have some kind of gross numbers that we usually reference, and then I'll explain why they are not more precise. So from different studies across the country, we know that the typical night in jail costs, let's say it costs around $100 a night to keep somebody in jail. Included in that cost is sort of fixed costs, right? I mean, you have the prison, you have the jail, the guards, certain, you know, things you have, whether someone's sleeping in a bed at the jail or not. And then you have the other costs associated with housing someone. So medical care, food, potentially extra security, depending on the number of inmates in the jail. And so let's just say it costs $100 a night to keep somebody in jail. It typically costs between $3 and $5 a day to supervise someone in the community. And that's even sort of at the, one might call, sort of significant support and supervision. So there is a huge cost difference, but that the reason it's a gross cost difference is, A, the cost of keeping someone in jail overnight varies dramatically across the country. But then on the program side, the sort of more historical pretrial programs would have people who interviewed people when they were first arrested. They would go into the cell blocks, conduct an interview, go back to the office, verify information gathered from the person who had just been arrested, prepare a report for the court, and go into court the next day. And then if the court ordered supervision, they would provide supervision.
Okay. Yeah, Charisse?
Was it something I said, Craig?
No, but we got disconnected. We just have like 2 minutes left. I had one other quick question. The disparity, one of the things I see, and by this I'm not necessarily, I know there's like racial disparity and that kind of stuff that I think people are aware of.
Sure.
But there's also between judges. Sometimes the exact same client with the same background and same crime, you go in front of one judge and your bail might be set at $50,000. You go in front of another judge, it might be $20,000. So can you, like in 1 minute, just summarize like if there's anything you're doing to try to combat that problem?
Well, first and foremost, we're working towards the end of money bond in America. And so I would answer it first and foremost that way. The second is that these decisions need to be transparent and on the record. So if you do have a judge who sets 50 and a different judge who had set 20, enter those reasons on the record so that the defense attorney can appeal those decisions if the person wishes to do so. But the use of and the switch to replacing the cash bail system with assessment tools that give judges better analysis of the information before them is what we're hoping will help reduce disparity between decision makers in this process.
Okay, Charisse, we are out of time. So
thanks
I want to thank you for joining us. And like to have you back another time later this year.
Love to. Okay. Please check out our website for more information, pretrial.org.
All right. Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Last month, I was in Lisbon, Portugal, and there I interviewed the chief scientist for the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction, Lucas Wiesing.
My name is Lucas Wiesing. I'm a Dutch epidemiologist at this European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction, the EMCDDA, based in Lisbon, Portugal. We collect data and try to provide evidence on the drug problem in Europe so that individual European countries can make their own policies.
Right. Portugal has done an amazing thing. They've set an example for the rest of the world, really, to follow. Much of Europe is, in fact, following them. Am I correct in that assumption?
In a certain sense, yes. I think you're right that Portugal has quite recently, in 2001, decriminalized the possession of drugs, so that if you're being caught by the police in possession of drugs, you're no longer going to jail. And there is a system of what they call dissuasion committees, where you will be interviewed and will be assessed for if you are problematic, then they will actually recommend drug treatment. If you're not problematic, you'll just have that interview and that's it. Portugal is obviously not is now the most recent example and has gone quite far in legally changing their law and decriminalizing. But of course, we have other countries in Europe, the Netherlands, for example, that has a long-term non-criminal policy by simply not enforcing the criminal law. And then you have countries outside the European Union, like Switzerland, which have been very forward also in, for example, what we call harm reduction, just like the Netherlands. So it's not just Portugal, and it started already a little bit before Portugal, but there are now a couple of countries, together with Portugal, that are moving in the, I would say, a right direction of seeing the drug problem as a health problem rather than as a judicial problem.
Right. I speak primarily about the United States. You know, we have arrested nearly 50 million of our citizens for mostly minor amounts of drugs. And it just seems that there's a lot of more difficult, more dangerous problems that we could be dealing with instead of wasting so much manpower there.
There is, as I told you before, also there's a sort of convergence in European countries in the last two decades there is a more focus on health, and it's what we call the balanced approach. So there is basically a balance between criminalizing the dealers, the big dealers, but not the users, not the small users, and the other pillar is then the health pillar, and of course also including harm reduction.
We'll have part two with European scientist Lucas Wiesing on tomorrow's report. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.